From Radio 720 WGN Chicago, it's time for Extension 720. Now here's your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
And here is an old friend who's been up to a wonderful caper, and it has now just finally manifested itself in an utterly riveting book, which everyone will want to buy, especially after they hear some excerpts. And what excerpts these are, Michael Beschloss. We're not just going to have you read some excerpts from the book. We are going to Lyndon Baines Johnson in private conversation, many private conversations, with all sorts of people. A word about these tapes, that I want to plunge in and play one or two of those excerpts.
Well, these are tapes that Johnson began making the very first day he became president. In fact, not only that, we can hear actually Johnson on Air Force One just after it takes off from Dallas, just after he's taken the oath after John Kennedy's murder, calling up Rose Kennedy in Hyannisport, consoling her on the death of her son. And, you know, it really brings it all back because you hear people screaming in the background and engines shrieking. And
Rose Kennedy's amazing on that little one. This is just a few hours after the murder of her son.
Really?
She gets off the line, thank you, I know you loved him and he loved you too.
It's quite lovely. And, you know, it's as if you had a tape of the hour after the Lincoln assassination or the day of Pearl Harbor. It's just the kind of thing that we Americans would love to be able to hear because it takes you right into that historical moment.
I want to plunge right into the setting and right into the life of this turbulent man who was larger than life and who turned our history, for better or for worse, decisively in certain directions we might not otherwise have gone. But here's something virtually domestic. Lyndon and Lady Bird, explain.
Well, this is March of 1964. LBJ has just given a press conference. And Lady Bird thought he was not very good at press conferences, so she would watch him on television and try to give him a critique, and she's brutally frank, as we're about to hear.
Mr. President?
Hello.
Bill.
Talk a little louder. We can't hear you.
Mrs. Johnson is calling, asking if she could speak to the president for a moment concerning his press conference.
You want to listen for about 1 minute to my critique, or would you rather wait till
tonight?
Yes,
ma'am. I'm willing now.
I thought that you looked strong, firm, and like a reliable guy. Your looks were splendid. The close-ups were much better than the distance ones.
Well, you can't get them to do it.
Well, I will say this. There were more close-ups than there were distance ones. During the statement, you were a little breathless. And there was too much looking down, and I think it was a little too fast. Not enough change of pace. A drop in voice at the end of sentence. There was a considerable pickup in drama and interest when the questioning began. Your voice was noticeably better, and your facial...
We'll be working our way towards the politics and the big decisions and the pressing of the flesh and so on shortly. But here we're starting with the inner domestic life of this man. On almost all the other excerpts that we've got to play, and in almost all the other many, many tapes that you've got transcribed in the new book, Taking Charge, Johnson is dominating any conversation.
And here he does not. And it really does give you a little bit of an insight into their relationship because... One thing, Milt, I really got after listening to 240 hours of these tapes and transcribing them for this book is that Johnson in private was in certain ways almost an emotional cripple. This is a guy who, through 63 and 64, should have been absolutely thrilled with his life. Here he was, finally president after all these years. He had wanted to be very popular after the death of John Kennedy. He knew he was on his way to one of the big landslides in all history. Yet you listen to him on these tapes, and this is someone who is deeply insecure. He's terrified a lot of the time. And you hear him almost going through these mood swings between elation, huge loss of temper. He screams at everyone on his staff. And then those alternate between real periods of dejection and depression. And the one person who sort of levels him, pulls him down when he gets up too much up, pulls him up when he gets too down, is Lady Bird. And really, she was almost his in-house psychiatrist in keeping him a little bit more balanced so that he could function as president.
But here is something quite interesting with regard to their relationship. It has been bruited about for years that he was actively extramarital. One would not have expected anything less, I suppose, from this larger-than-life, assertive, self-made Texan politician and multimillionaire.
Absolutely.
But I never knew too much about his various liaisons, and I discovered from your book that one of them was with a woman who, when he first met her, I guess was a fellow member of the House of Representatives, who had already been an established Hollywood actress, Helen Gehagen Douglas, the wife of Melvin Douglas. And you assert, you yourself, rather boldly, and just in a line or two, that they had had an intimate relationship in those early days. And here, much later, just within a week or so after the assassination, and just a few days after his speech to the nation, which I remember watching with, as all the nation watched it, with tremendous concern and with tremendous gratification, because he seemed to be rising to the occasion and giving us a kind of reassurance and a kind of leadership that we needed. And everyone starts congratulating him on that speech. And I'm not sure who initiated this call. Did they call him or did he call them?
This is LBJ calling Helen Gehagen Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
New Year's Day, 1964. They had had this romance that went all the way back to exactly as you say, Milt, when LBJ and she were in the House of Representatives. She was a great crusading liberal. He loved that in her.
She later became a senator.
Well, she ran for this.
Ran for the Senate against Richard Nixon.
1950, and that was the year in which Nixon ran against Helen Douglas, denounced her as the Pink Lady, soft on communism, and basically destroyed her political career. And Johnson says she was a fine woman, and Nixon destroyed her. It's one reason why Johnson detested Richard Nixon.
Now, in this conversation, the two spouses, Lady Bird sitting next to Lyndon, and Melvin Douglas, the well-known Hollywood actor, in the living room with his wife, I guess, they also get in on the conversation. And everybody loves everybody.
The whole thing is a little bit like Noel Coward, because you wonder how much the two spouses know, and if they do know, whether they're just sort of play-acting or whether everyone is being civilized. And the other thing that's interesting in terms of Johnson is that what you're about to hear him say is he's offering Helen Douglas a place on a ceremonial mission to Africa, but what he's really trying to do is to give her a position of some stature to help restore her prestige that was so badly injured in the Nixon campaign.
It's one of the most fascinating bits of dramatic dialogue I've ever heard. Here it is.
Hello?
Hello,
Happy New Year, sweetheart.
Happy New Year. You're doing wonderfully.
Oh, I don't know.
Yes, you are.
Say, I got some...
I said an absolute... admiration and, it's just, everything is just right.
I'm cutting down the military bases and some of these archaic, old, old-fashioned things, and Khrushchev's cutting his down, too, so we got a good...
that's the best of everything, and while I think of it...
I'm taking that money and putting it into poverty.
That's good, and there's lower.
Then I'm going to have a budget that's lower than they've ever had it.
Wonderful. That's terrific.
It's just it's what you emphasize. And I want you to do something for me.
Yeah.
I want you to go as my representative with Dr. Wright from Fisk University to Liberia for their 100th anniversary of the relations between the United States and Liberia. And I'd like to go myself. I told the vice president I'd try to come, but I can't do it. And it's this Saturday.
This Saturday.
What you shouting about? That's 4 days longer than you usually have.
Oh, Linda. Listen,
come on, chicken, now. Don't chicken on me.
Yeah.
This will be good for you. I want you to get back in the public eye a little bit, and I want you to... you won't have to be gone 3 or 4 days. And just get your little teddies ready.
Wait, I call Mel. Melvin! Come here, dear.
Don't tell... I thought you ran your own house. Don't tell me that you got to clear things with Sydney.
Of course I have to clear things with Sydney.
This reference dates back to 1944 when Republicans accused Franklin Roosevelt of requiring that major decisions be cleared with the labor leader Sidney Hillman.
That's Liberia. You just go and see how they're doing, and I'll see you after you get back. We're going to have to run against Nixon, and I'm just going to have you run against him because he treated you so unfairly.
Listen. You know, I've set that time aside.
Yeah.
so. But, Lyndon, one last thing. Don't overdo yourself.
Quit lecturing me now.
No, but don't.
You quit lecturing me, I'll put you back in the Army.
All right.
Yeah. You don't...
Mel wants to say something. You know what Mel said to me the other night?
No.
Oh, I don't know, you haven't been in more than 3 days. He turned suddenly and looked at me. You know, he never knew you the way I did.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, he just might be one of the really great ones.
Hello, sir.
Hi, Melvin. How are you?
That is what I said. I said, you know, this man might just turn out to be one hell of a president.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you. I hope I'm a hell of as good a president as you are in your profession.
Yeah.
And we're mighty proud of you. And I just wanted Helen to get back in the limelight a little bit. I see they're pulling Nixon out, so I just wanted to run her a little bit. I wanted to go and represent the president Saturday for 3 or 4 days at Liberia 100th anniversary. And I was going and wanted to go myself when I was vice president, but this tragedy happened, and I can't go, and I want to... somebody that's compassionate and understanding and to represent the president. So I think it's good for her. And Lady Bird won't say...
but a wonderful new year to you, and keep it up. And I'll...
Thank you, Melvin. Lady Bird won't say a word to you and then to Helen, too.
All right, just a minute.
Melvin?
Hello, dear. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. And one of the nicest things that could happen to us in the new year would be to get to see you and Helen.
You're so sweet. This is one of the nicest things that could happen to us because we both have just sat here with our mouths open in admiration of both of you.
Don't worry. Hard times will come, and you all may have to take it all back, but I'll tell you, you never saw a man try harder. That much I'll say.
Here's Helen. She wants to say hello to you.
Hey, Bert.
Oh, Helen.
Oh, wonderful.
So nice to hear you. And, honey, let me take...
You know what praises you get out here? And you know that I've had out here, we're in California now, and that person after person has said, you know, those Republican friends of ours said the first Democratic president ever going to vote for them.
Well, I hope that didn't make you lose any
No, it's just wonderful.
Lyndon sent you the sassy message, which I guess I'm used to it because I like for women to like him, and I like for him to like them. But anyhow, he said that he and Roz Wyman hit it off very well indeed, partly because of you.
With typical...
That is so multi-layered. But clearly one thing you really catch there is a sense of intimacy between Johnson and Helen Hagen Douglas.
And it was a real romance, and you also have a sense of what kind of a romance it was, which is Helen Douglas doted on Lyndon Johnson almost as if he was a small boy. And did you hear, Milt, the way that he almost basked in her praise when she said nice things?
Yeah, yeah. And Lady Bird, now, Lady Bird's an interesting study, and she's still around. All the other people in that conversation are not. In fact, she was the one who decided to release these tapes, wasn't she?
She was. It was the Johnson Library's decision, but I'm sure they would not have done it without her assent.
Johnson, upon his close to his death, left some bequest saying these are not to be made available, not to be heard by anybody until, 50 years or so after his death?
Yeah, you know, it was one of the biggest secrets he ever kept. During the presidency, very few people knew that these tapes were being made. Not most of his aides, not even most of his family. And in fact, when Lady Bird, for instance, called him up, that conversation we heard a few minutes earlier, she had no idea that the tape recorder was running. And that was even true after Johnson went back to Texas. He had all these tapes locked up in a vault, and just before he died, he called in an old female assistant and said, I'm not feeling well, and I think I'm going to die soon, and if I die, I want you to make sure that these are closed for at least 50 years, and as far as I'm concerned, most of these should never be opened. He was worried about hurting living people.
You get a sense that Lady Bird, if she didn't know about this earlier affair, must have known about many others, and that something almost monarchical or rather reminds you of the court of Louis XIV or what have you. She's perfectly tolerant and expects that that's part of the, that goes with the territory, so to speak.
You know, I could not have said it better. That's just what I was about to say.
Yeah. Have you talked with her?
I have, not about this subject.
No,
I hope you'll forgive me, Milt. I had dinner with her about a week ago.
I wouldn't forgive you if you had. That would not be discreet for an old woman.
She's 85 and amazingly alert and actually very eager to see history of her husband written.
Well, this book contributes a great deal to that history. Indeed, it gives us a view of him which is confirms some things we've known about him or thought about him, but also highlights the total profile, some elements of the profile, in different ways, so that a different sort of man does emerge, at least in my reading and in my estimation. And we'll talk more about that. And we'll talk also then about the politics and the great decisions of state as we catch him in the middle of handling some of those. All of that to follow and to continue right after we pause for these words.
And now the conversation continues on Extension 720 from Radio 720 WGN. Here's Milt Rosenberg.
We return to Michael Beschloss. Those who watch television regularly, particularly watch the Lehrer Report, of course, have seen Michael Beschloss again and again. You're sort of a member of that stable, aren't you?
Yeah, we're on about every week or two and have a very good time doing it.
Are you on usually with...
With Doris Kearns Goodwin and Hans Johnson.
And so you're a panel of three.
Panel of three, oftentimes with Jim Lehrer and oftentimes with Phil Ponce, who's just come to us from Chicago, whom we're really delighted to have.
Actually, Doris Kearns Goodwin is going to be here in just about a month or so with her
tremendous
new book about baseball.
Oh, which is a wonderful book. I can recommend it to everyone.
Well, she grew up as a Dodger fan in Brooklyn, as did I. So, and we've got other things in common. She's an old friend. But we're looking forward to that. I said a moment ago that though we all have had images of Lyndon Johnson, especially if you're old enough to have been conscious during his presidency, as surely I am, what did the kids shout as they marched around the White House?
Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?
Exactly. And the general image that was widely shared was this guy was gung-ho for victory in Vietnam. He was super macho in the Texas style, and he went in there fiercely and with full commitment, thinking that we must beat the communists there. This is a good place where we can really beat the communists and reverse the tide, or else the dominoes will begin to fall all the way across the world, ultimately affecting us in a dreadful way. So this was a crucial war that had to be fought and had to be won, and he was the one who escalated it because he was the one who had the passion for it. Not Kennedy, who was in there, not Eisenhower, who first put us in there with a little corps of military advisors, but it was really Lyndon's war. And then it was Nixon's war. Turns out not really exactly to be the way he approached it in privacy at all.
You know, not a bit. And I was growing up here in Chicago at the time, and I was 7 years old when Lyndon Johnson became president. And I was also in the last draft lottery. My number was 92 in 1972, I think it was. And if there had been a draft, I would have gone to Vietnam. So it was very much a part of my life. And the thing that was surprising to me is that the Lyndon Johnson in private on these tapes is not the guy you see in the Oliver Stone film, the sort of Texas cowboy who's just aching for a big war in Vietnam to please the military-industrial complex. Actually, he's making a lot of the arguments in 1964 in private that many people who hated the war by 1968 were making in public when they were marching by the White House. And the interesting thing, Milton, is that he's saying these things largely to the foreign affairs advisors who were inherited from John Kennedy, of whom he was a little bit intimidated.
Halberstam's famous best and brightest.
Best and the brightest. No one has said it better.
McGeorge Bundy,
Robert McNamara.
Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense. Sorensen.
Ted Sorensen. Dean Rusk.
Dean Rusk, of course, Secretary of State.
And they're all sort of around him like policemen, and every time he says a very good reason why we should not get involved in Vietnam, as I think we'll hear in a moment, we'll hear him saying himself, you've got Bundy or one of these others almost tending him like a policeman saying, you'd better not do things like that. If you don't save Vietnam, we're going to lose the Cold War. We've got treaties there. And almost sort of saying, John Kennedy would have gotten us into this war, and if you do not follow what he would have done, we're going to resign and denounce you.
Yes, and the implicit threat, though he is fully aware of it, and whether in this excerpt or in others, he does articulate it, is that this could ruin my political career. I might not get elected when I run for a full term. He even suggests in one of the conversations, if I chicken out and withdraw troops, and he inherited only 18,000 Americans in Vietnam when he first came to the presidency after the assassination, but he speculates, if I withdraw Then Bobby Kennedy, with whom he's locked in some kind of mortal combat till the very end, till Bobby Kennedy's assassination. If I withdraw, Bobby Kennedy will take the hard line and criticize me for being a coward and for not holding American interests to the fore, and he will take the presidency away from me. It's a touch paranoid, and I don't know whether that's a proper projection. I think
I wouldn't say a touch, Milton.
More than a touch. Well, we'll talk more of this anon, but let's hear him now. He's in conversation with McGeorge Bundy. Explain a little bit about the setting of this.
Bundy was a classic example of the best and the brightest. He had been dean of faculty at Harvard. Bundy was one of these people of whom Sam Rayburn said, Kennedy's aides are very bright and very articulate, but I sure wish that one of them had run for county sheriff. Bundy was wonderful in terms of abstract strategy, but knew virtually nothing about the American people. And here he is talking to Johnson, who pours his heart out, and watch the way, as I've suggested, he sort of reacts to Johnson almost like a policeman intended to keep him to the straight and narrow.
And at this time, Bundy's position in the circle around Johnson is National Security Advisor.
Absolutely.
Head of the National Security Council.
And Johnson is terrified that Bundy is going to quit and say that President Johnson is incompetent in foreign affairs, so he's doing almost anything to keep him.
What's the date of this one?
This is May of 1964.
I'll tell you, the more I just stayed awake last night thinking about this thing, the more I think of it, I don't know what in the hell. It looks like me, we're getting into another Korea. It just worries the hell out of me. I don't see what we can ever hope to get out of there with once we're committed. I believe the Chinese communists coming into it. I don't think that we can fight them 10,000 miles away from home and ever get anywhere in that area. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. And it's just the biggest damn mess.
It's an awful mess.
And we just got to think about it. I look at this sergeant of mine this morning, got six little old kids over there, and he's getting out my things and bringing me in my night reading and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought about ordering those kids in there, and what in the hell am I ordering him out there for?
One thing that
is Vietnam worth to me? What is Laos worth to me? What is it worth to this country? We got a treaty, but hell, everybody else got a treaty out there, and they're not doing anything about it.
Yeah.
Now, of course, if you start running the communists, they may just chase you right into your own kitchen.
Yeah, that's the trouble. That is what the rest of the, that half of the world is going to think if this thing comes apart on us. That's the dilemma. That's exactly the dilemma.
But everybody I talk to that's got any sense in here, they just says, oh, my God, please give us those. Of course, I was reading Mansfield stuff this morning, and it's just milk toast as it can be. He got no spine at all.
Yeah.
But this is a terrible thing we're getting ready to do.
Mr. President, I just think it's the biggest, it's the only big decision in one sense that this one is one we're having either. We either reach up and get it or we let it go by, and I'm not telling you today what I'd do in your position. I just think the most we have to do is to pray with it for another while.
Did you see the poll this morning? 65% of them don't know anything about it.
They
and of those
know.
That do, the majority think we're mishandling it, but
I'm
they
sure
don't know what to
right.
do. That's Gallup.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's damned easy to get in war, but it's going to be awfully hard to ever extricate yourself
very
if you get
easy.
In.
I'm very sensitive to the fact that people who are having trouble with an intransigent problem find it very easy to come and say to the President of the United States, go and be tough.
Well, Michael, the basic question is, I already gave my version of an answer to this question, but I'm more interested in yours. The basic question is, knowing what he did, feeling the way he did, as we hear on that tape, why in the world did he go from 18,000 non-combatants to 500,000 combatants, Americans in Vietnam?
Couple of things. One is, you know, listening to Bundy reacting to what Johnson is saying, Johnson's making wonderful sense. And the reason he's saying that there are going to be all sorts of problems with this war, Americans won't support it, the Senate won't support it, we might lose, that comes from being 35 years in American politics and talking to an awful lot of people that McGeorge Bundy had never spoken to in his life. And I just, when I heard that, I so much wished that there was an aide to Johnson who was sitting there saying, you know, you're the one who has the political experience and I don't, and your instincts are actually good. Honor your instincts, because if you get deeply into this war, it could cause great problems.
But do you agree with what I was suggesting before? I said it rather vaguely, that it's also the politician in him finally who decides to escalate and go for the victory in Vietnam. He thinks his own political future is tied to hanging tough in Vietnam.
Absolutely, and it was one of the biggest tragedies for this nation that Johnson had to make these fundamental decisions in 1964, in the middle of a presidential campaign against perhaps the most military-minded Republican candidate, perhaps even in American history, Barry Goldwater, who was already denouncing Johnson as soft on communism, insufficiently strong in Vietnam. Yeah. And by the time that campaign was over, Johnson had made very basic decisions that he had almost trapped himself.
You were only 7 years old or so at that time, were you? I was a little bit older. And I remember that campaign, though you've read much more about it, I'm sure, than I have. But I remember some of the slogans. A Republican slogan for Goldwater on the Goldwater posters was, "In your heart, you know he's right." And the Democratic riposte to that was, you remember what it was?
Yes, extreme far right.
No, no. Well, there was another one. In your heart, you know he's nuts.
Yes, also.
Goldwater. That he was the hawk, and he was the guy, after all, who said, let's lob one into the men's room in the Kremlin at some other point of American-Soviet tension. So Johnson ran as the peace candidate, essentially, already having made the decision to go to a heavy war.
Absolutely. And, you know, another slogan, Milt, that Goldwater used that year was, why not victory?
Yeah.
And the suggestion there was, why had the United States, for the previous 20 years or so, not used its nuclear superiority against the Soviet Union, or at least defeated them in places like Southeast Asia? And the answer tacitly was, the Democrats didn't do it because they were somehow, in some way, soft in fighting the Soviets and communism around the world.
It's part of the heritage of McCarthyism, really.
And Johnson had lived very much through that period. I don't think he ever worried that he would ever be successfully painted as a communist, but he knew how desperately that had been used against Democrats like Truman and Stevenson.
Well, that was the natural disadvantage in the Cold War years of the Democratic Party. Somehow, the American public was vaguely persuaded that the Republicans were tough on communism and Democrats were too prone to negotiating and to settling and to tolerating communist expansion.
That's exactly right, and that's why you see people like LBJ trying to prove that they are not guilty. They're sort of guilty until proven innocent, and why a Richard Nixon could recognize China and then finally pull out of Vietnam.
Yeah, the point was often made at that time, only Nixon could have recognized China, no Democratic president could have got away with it.
That's right. And it's another thing that the tapes show. Johnson says on the tapes, we should have recognized Red China in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
He says in private, had he said that in public at the time, he would have been crucified.
The presidency, you've studied all the modern presidents. You've done books on four or five of them already.
Nearly all of them.
Yeah. The presidency is, I suppose, in some ways a prison cell or a trap of some kind. You are as much the product of the forces acting upon you as you are the source of those forces acting upon others.
I think that's true, and that is particularly true if you're a president making foreign policy or military decisions during a presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I think as an historian, if I could dictate a rule for American politics, it would be don't ever let a president make important foreign policy decisions or military decisions in that kind of atmosphere, because people say things that they shouldn't. They get trapped into corners that they don't want to get trapped into. Just think of 1940. That was the year that Franklin Roosevelt made that empty promise, your boys will not be sent into any foreign wars. Even 1952, Dwight Eisenhower ran as a candidate promising to roll back communism in Europe, even though he knew that that was impossible that year. 1960, John Kennedy tries to outbid Richard Nixon on Cuba, trying to suggest that he would be more aggressive. These are usually really horrible exercises, and Lyndon Johnson on Vietnam in 64 was perhaps the worst.
Kennedy in 60 also, of course, runs on the accusation that the Republicans, Eisenhower, have allowed a missile gap favoring the Soviets to develop.
Which never existed.
Which wasn't there.
It was absolutely false.
Yeah. So presidents are not free. But still, some may handle their responsibilities with a greater sense of the ultimate good.
I think that's right. And in Johnson's case, there's a real problem here because he never cared all that much about foreign affairs. He was the flip side of John Kennedy, who loved foreign policy, was impatient with things like poverty and civil rights. And the result is that Johnson comes into the presidency seeing Vietnam basically as a domestic political problem. How do I sort of hold the line so that I'm not criticized, so that I can work in Congress on the things that I really care about, which is things like civil rights and battling poverty?
But the cost is not merely billions of dollars spent on that war, thus helping to build our tremendous national debt. But, of course, the more significant cost is millions of lives, not just the 53 or so thousand American lives, but that was a lengthy war, and a number of millions of Vietnamese and Laotians and Cambodians were killed in that war.
Absolutely.
Life was spent. And did any of those guys, the best and the brightest, these patricians surrounding him, or did he himself, sitting surrounded by those patrician policy analysts, did any of them really feel that and think about it?
No sign of it on these tapes in 1963 and 1964. Johnson really comes out the best. He may not come out very well as I do the two more volumes getting past the year 1964, but, you know, these were the years in which America went off the rails, and largely because of that war.
And in ultimately, the response to that war was a kind of social revolution within the country. The new left emerges, the universities go into some kind of revolt, and a new kind of counterculture develops, which has had consequences down to the present moment. Most of them, I think, in my old crusty conservative judgment, rather disastrous consequences.
Well, you know, and you look at a year like 1963 and 64, the year that the book covers, a lot of the things that we're talking about really go back to then, both good and bad. That was the year that John Kennedy was murdered. People wondered whether it was a conspiracy or not. That has poisoned the American soul to this day, the number of people who are still absolutely animated and haunted by the question of what happened there. It was also the year that Lyndon Johnson got a civil rights bill through Congress that allowed African Americans to use hotels and restaurants for the first time, gave them a lot of rights that they had never had before, changed this country for the good, and then overshadowing all of it at the same time as Vietnam, and you've got a president dealing with all these things at the same time.
How intelligent was he?
I think he was probably, in terms of raw IQ, at the top among the presidents of this century.
Do you really?
I do, perhaps tied with Bill Clinton, who I think, and this is not a comment on Bill Clinton's leadership or ideology or anything else, but in terms of just raw brain power, I think he's a very smart man, and I would put LBJ really in the same class.
Yeah.
He was not educated, he wasn't the least bit disciplined, but in terms of just raw brain power, quite good.
We will return to Michael Beschloss. We are drawing from his wonderful new book, Taking Charge, the Johnson White House Tapes, 1963 to 1964, edited and with commentary by Michael R. Beschloss, that is published by Simon & Schuster. And we should say, I should note, that appearing with this is a, what I guess is called an audiobook. It's four tapes issued in a neat little package, and the tapes are of a number of these conversations. Those four tapes, I suppose, give you about 4 hours of the material.
Actually, six, and you hear LBJ's actual voice, as we're hearing tonight, introduced and explained by me. And the audiobook has been apparently submitted for a Grammy, and I've been told that if it wins, the prize is accepted jointly by myself and Lyndon.
Well, I should think so. Somebody will have to stand. Maybe Lady Bird would stand in for Lyndon at the
Be
award.
Terrific.
Yeah. We pause for the usual reasons, and then directly back to Michael R. Beschloss and to Lyndon Baines Johnson.
You're listening to Extension 720 on Radio 720 WGN. Once again, Milt Rosenberg.
And directly back to Michael Beschloss and back to Lyndon Baines Johnson. Well, we've reached the point where I can ask you for, but we're going to hear more of these tapes, of course, but ask you for your considered, your magisterial judgment on all of this. Who exactly was Lyndon Baines Johnson? How does one characterize his presidency as compared to the adjoining presidencies?
Well, in private, he was a deeply terrified man, and I think that's the key to this whole period because, you know, I kept on thinking when I was listening to these tapes comparing LBJ to someone like Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt, during World War II, had to go through the first year of that war and deal with a lot of defeats. And if Roosevelt had had a little bit less self-confidence, I think he would have locked himself in the White House basement and said, we're going to lose this war, let's just resign ourselves to defeat. It was Roosevelt's self-confidence that was a national asset and enabled him to let his optimism spread to the rest of the nation.
He was able on the hardest days to put the, at 5 o'clock or so, put it all aside, call in some of the ladies who worked in the White House and make them martinis, which
absolutely,
he was very proud of. And they would sit there and gossip about people they knew.
And you would have thought that Roosevelt in a situation like this was in a world situation that was the happiest it could be, rather than losing World War II in 1942. And you compare that to LBJ, who is almost the opposite. In 1963 and 1964, almost everything that happens to him, even very minor, amid a background of great popularity and control of the Democratic Party, he overreacts to.
He's sort of terror-stricken, is he?
He is. I mean, for instance, there is this, in today's terms, mini-scandal over Bobby Baker, his former Senate aide. And you hear Johnson on these tapes, he's panicked and hysterical and says, I think I'm going to jail if the Senate investigation doesn't stop.
Well, he needs some of the sang-froid of Bill Clinton, I would say.
I think that is something that he could have benefited from. And another example is the Washington Star and other newspapers do not swallow Johnson's claim that his net worth is $300,000. Something he was very sensitive about was the charge, absolutely true, that he had made an awful lot of money while serving in public life, went from basically scratch in 1950 to probably a net worth of about $12 million when he became president. And when newspapers ran these articles, he would become very upset and thought it was all going to come crashing down. And, you know, his worst nightmare always was that he'd get to the Democratic convention, August of 64, the delegates would be about to cast their ballots, and just as they were about to nominate Lyndon, Jackie Kennedy would walk onto the stage and say, throw down your placards, you should nominate my brother-in-law, Bobby Kennedy, and they all would, and LBJ would have been thrown out on the boardwalk or something in Atlantic City. It was a ridiculous nightmare because Lyndon Johnson owned the Democratic Party, but the point is that this was a man who had such insecurity in his soul that he really was not able to deal with a lot of these problems, and I think that private character that you see on these tapes has an absolutely direct relationship to what happened with LBJ in Vietnam.
But about his relation with Bobby Kennedy, apparently he held the man in, if not contempt, he had sort of lasting rage and resentment against the man, but it was fully reciprocated.
The two men hated each other, and that's not a word I would toss around very loosely. And the thing was that Johnson always felt that Bobby Kennedy was 20 feet tall. When there's a bad press article about LBJ, LBJ always thinks that Bobby is behind it. When the black leaders and black citizens of Brooklyn and Harlem and Rochester are rioting, or at least involved in complaints about Johnson on civil rights, Johnson always thinks that Bobby Kennedy is behind it. He thinks that Bobby Kennedy is basically behind every one of his troubles.
Yet he uses tremendous courtesy in some of his phone conversations with Bobby Kennedy, sort of unctuous flattery, almost.
At least on the surface, but what the tapes also show is that Johnson used the FBI and other weapons of presidential power against Bobby Kennedy, asking for damaging information to be collected on files that Johnson can use against him.
We've got a number of conversations between LBJ and Robert Kennedy, and let's listen to one of them. This is charged. As you listen, you have to ask yourself, what are they really feeling and thinking about one another?
Well, Mr. President.
Hi, Bobby.
How are you?
Fine.
I was just talking, Mr. President, to Mac Bundy on the phone. I heard of this incident of last night, and I asked him if the congressional people had been informed about it, and he didn't think that they probably had.
No.
And, you know, it's going to come out from the Chinese, and it's going to come out in other ways, and I thought it was rather a matter that would be well if it was handled.
Yeah, and I think so. Some of them have been, but it hasn't been done as a group. And I don't know whether the Republicans would bring it out and leak it or not. That's a great question.
But, of course, the Chinese will talk about it, and the Russians will talk about it, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to, I would think you can expect that it's going to be, within 24 hours, it'll be worldwide, and if we had done it without telling anybody in the United States, they're all going to wonder, you know, I would think that that's going to be a problem. The second thing is, it seems to me that somebody should be working on how it will be handled with the public, because the Chinese obviously will say something about it. And what are we going to say, and whether we'd repeat it. And
I raised that question with them, and I've got another meeting at 1 o'clock where I'll raise it again. The Boeing State Department and McNamara both have had that question put to them by me. What's the man over there that runs their publicity? In State.
Manning.
And I think he's been one of the best.
Yes.
His feeling was that we shouldn't do anything about it. My feeling was that we ought to go ahead and say something. McNamara agreed with him. I'm seeing them at 1 o'clock again, and we took the ball the other day and said that we had taken this action and announced it ourselves, and I thought got by with pretty well with the other two flights. It doesn't look like they got much results last night, what they did. Have you analyzed it?
I haven't. I just, I just heard about it on the telephone. But
are you going to meet with them any time today or tomorrow?
I hadn't heard of it.
I told Mac Bundy to get you, because we've got to see where we go from here.
Yes.
They have no real plans. McNamara and Rusk are both... We're rather insistent on going through with this one, although the ambassador raised some grave questions which concern me. A, the reaction in the world, and B, Savannah's reaction. But they felt that unless we showed some strength and made some kind of reply, that it would be very bad for us. And we went ahead, but they were confident they could knock this battery out. They didn't, and I think it shows us that we can't rely too much on air power on some of these things.
No, I think that's a real lesson. The other, I had, about 4 or 5 days ago, we went through the plan for Vietnam, and I had some serious questions about it, that perhaps they're going to have some other discussions with you. But, I mean, for instance, the congressional part of it and getting the congressional resolution, I think it poses all kinds of problems.
You can't do anything about that until you get rid of this problem we've got up there now. And the question is whether you ought to try is a difficult one. And I don't know how you can conduct much offensive without some authority.
Yeah.
We had the United Nations behind us, but we had a very divided country and a lot of hell, and we finally really lost, the Democrats did, on the Korea thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, we know there are virtually mortal enemies. You're not the first to testify to that, but if you just listen to that without knowing any of the history, you would think these are men of pretty similar mind and shared concerns, and they are comfortable with one another.
Yeah,
strange.
It's sort of man bites dog. And, you know, it just sort of fills you with a sense of tragedy, because on political issues in 1963 and 1964, Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy agreed on probably 98% of things. And at the time that we just heard that conversation, Milt, the two are working side by side on trying to get a civil rights bill through Congress because Robert Kennedy was Attorney General, and you just wish that they had been able to work together on other issues the same way.
You know, I've said this before, I think, about Johnson, or at least it's someplace stored in my protoplasmic file. And it just occurs to me again, there's a line in Macbeth which wonderfully captures, I think, the preoccupation of Lyndon Baines Johnson. Shortly after Macbeth, in this case having murdered King Duncan, is being sort of praised by his wife and looking forward to wonderful things and so on, he says, "To be thus is nothing, but to be safely thus. I've got it now, but how long will I be able to hold it?" And you get the feeling that all through his presidency, he's preoccupied. I've got it. I am thus, but I am not yet safely thus. And the main threat in terms of direct personification seems to be Robert Kennedy. Was Kennedy really a threat? What was Kennedy's attitude with regard to how resentful was he that Johnson was the president? Obviously, he carried the wound of his brother's murder. And we know, we've read that he opposed his brother, when his brother first formed the intention of asking Johnson to be his vice presidential candidate.
That's right, and RFK also, and you can hear on the tapes from the very beginning, felt that LBJ had not behaved well after John Kennedy was murdered. He was angry that LBJ took the oath in Dallas rather than Washington. He felt that Robert Kennedy did, that he would have liked to see President Kennedy return to Washington one last time as president, the late president.
I don't see how you can be a president if you're dead.
Well, that's right, but this was a very sentimental man, as you know. And the other thing was that while most of us would have felt that Johnson had done a pretty good job of walking that line between, on the one hand, being sensitive to the Kennedy's feelings, and on the other hand, giving the American people a sense that here was a president in charge after the martyred president had been taken away, Robert Kennedy kept on feeling that Johnson seemed eager to seize power, was a usurper. And also the main thing was that in 1964, Robert Kennedy himself wanted to be president or vice president, and he knew that LBJ was the obstacle to those ambitions.
Well, he wasn't. Was he really contemplating a possible coup de party, so to speak, in which he would knock him out of the nomination, or was he merely...
But by the summer of 1964, RFK realized that his best bet remained being vice president, although in LBJ's mind that was never an option.
Why wasn't it?
Because LBJ says on the tapes, I'm not going to put someone in bed with me who wants to kill me.
Who wants to kill me.
And that's exactly what he thought of RFK from the very beginning, and that is one reason why he was so suspicious.
Why did he keep him as Attorney General?
Johnson had, and this was a big mistake, and he came to feel that it was a mistake too, he felt that if any of the Kennedy people resigned, it would be embarrassing to him. It would look as if the Kennedy people had a lack of confidence in this man who was a president by accident, the accident of Dallas. And the result was that he went to ridiculous lengths trying to keep these people in their jobs. And one of the lengths to which he went was to be rather quiet and deferential with people like Bundy and McNamara on Vietnam.
Hmm. We have some commercials waiting again. In fact, they are, of course, overdue. And then I want to come to something of great local interest. We've got one conversation between Lyndon Johnson and Richard Daley. Richard Daley the first, back in, well, in the same period, late 1963 or early 1964. We return to Michael Beschloss. We are drawing from his new book and from his new audio tape, which has been issued in four tapes that I've been listening to with utter rapt attention for the last day. Taking Charge is the title of the book, and I guess also the title of the tape package. Taking Charge, the Johnson White House tapes, 1963-1964, just published by Simon & Schuster.
You're listening to Radio 720, WGN Chicago. What's going on? Welcome back to Extension 720. Again, your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
And Michael Beschloss is a more or less native Chicago boy. That is the case, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. More than less. I was born here in Michael Reese Hospital and lived here all my life till about the age of 21.
Till 21? But you went to Williams College. You must have gone there earlier than 21.
Went away to school, and actually went away to boarding school as well, but always, and to this day, consider Chicago my home.
Actually, there was that one wonderful night when you were here with your old professor, James McGregor Burns, one of the most distinguished members of the political science profession, who was your teacher at Williams College.
He was, and we were here, as you'll remember, Milt, doing a joint lectureship at Loyola and had a wonderful time.
And he's just turned 80, you were telling me before.
Just 80, and they're naming a little school of leadership after him at the University of Maryland next week.
Well, he did a great book on leadership. What's the exact title? You know it better than I do, I'm sure.
Easy to remember, just called Leadership.
Just Leadership.
Sort of the standard work in the field.
Yeah, and it bears directly upon the analysis of presidential performance, obviously.
Yes, absolutely. And he drew on all the years that he had dealt with these issues. And actually, Johnson mentions Jim Burns on these tapes, as I've got in the book, because he's talking about the shortcomings of Congress, and he says, you don't want to do all those things that James McGregor Burns says, and what James McGregor Burns had said that year in a book you'll remember well called Deadlock of Democracy was that Congress doesn't do enough.
But I mentioned your Chicago origins because we're now striking the Chicago note as we play yet another of these tapes. This is the conversation between Richard Daley and LBJ. Explain.
This is January of 1964, and LBJ, to use his own language, is trying to get the Democratic bosses in line for 1964. So he's calling up Daley, and he's also worried that Daley might not be very friendly because the old mayor, Daley, of course, was deeply fond of Jack Kennedy. They were very close, as was Mayor Daley and Joe Kennedy, the late president's father. So LBJ is trying to keep his fences mended with Mayor Daley, and he's also saying, you should support my war on poverty because that's going to be a lot of money that I can send right into Chicago to your friends.
And it ends with a very interesting note. I wonder if anybody will remember the man who's mentioned at the very end of this excerpt. Here it is.
Mayor Daley is calling you on 9-1.
Yes, sir.
Mr. President?
How you doing, my friend?
How are you?
I'm just doing fine. Hope you are.
I love everything you're doing. You're doing great. We're very proud of you.
Somebody told me I was supposed to come out there and collect some money for you and try to make a speech.
Well, if you do, we left the biggest reception. You know, we put a mine out here, as we always, and surely love to see you and Mrs. Jansen out here.
I'm a Dick Daley. 23rd. I'm a Dick Daley man. We'll be there.
We're a Jansen men because, by God, Mr. President, really, I mean it. All I hear is everything wonderful about you. You're doing a great job, and may the Lord continue to give you health to carry out the responsibilities the way you're doing it.
Well, thank you, Dick. Thank you.
You're a great president.
Well,
what I'm calling you about is this Edward Hannah.
I'll never forget how you treated me in the 60 thing, and I always have a warm spot for you.
I know. We always felt, my wife said, never did we meet a finer couple than you and Mrs. Jackson, and we've never forgotten.
Are you looking at things for me in the Midwest?
You're going great, and that's what I want to say, and I'm not flattering you because, you know, I'd say it if we weren't doing so well. I think your conduct of the office, your humility, your courage, your determination, that program, that fight on poverty has got them all swirling around, the opposition, they don't know where they're going. I think it was an excellent idea. I think you put it out in concise language so that everyone could understand it, and we're picking it up out here tremendously in every ward organization, every township organization, and this is our program for 1964.
We got to have some real demonstration in Chicago on this anti-poverty program that we can coordinate.
This will be wonderful, and this is all a part of what we're trying to do, and under your leadership.
What I wish you'd do, I wish you'd get your local people together through local initiative and let us cooperate and establish the coordinating mechanisms of planning and developing what you think ought to be done for it there in Chicago, and then we get this money, we can drop a hunk of it in there and do it.
That'll be great.
But get your planning and development people busy right now to see what you do for the crummiest place in town, the lowest to the bottom thing, and see what we can do about it, and we'll get our dough, and then you can have your plan ready, and we'll move.
Wonderful. I appreciate it very much, and I wanted you to know that we're all very much interested in the appointment of Ed Hanrahan as district attorney.
Is that what you want?
He's a great Democrat. He ran for Congress. He was defeated. He's a graduate of Notre Dame and of Harvard, but more than that, Mr. President, let me say with great honor and pride, he's a precinct captain.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm a
militant. Conducted himself. He's got a family, and he's got integrity and decency.
Is he your man?
Yes, he is.
Do you want him?
We surely do.
You got him? You got him?
You have to have lived in Chicago a long time, I think, to remember Ed Hanrahan. He's best remembered, as you were just saying to me as we were listening, for the raid on Fred Hampton's apartment. A number of Black Panthers killed in that raid. Hanrahan, interestingly, Daley calls him, says he wants him appointed as district attorney. It's federal attorney for the
U.S. attorney, I think.
Or U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois.
I think that's right, and you know, it's just classic Richard Daley, and you know, these tapes capture not only LBJ in private, but also people like the old Mayor Daley and sort of what they were like. We rarely heard what he sounded like in private, and he says, Hanrahan is great, he went to Notre Dame, he went to Harvard, but most of all, may I say with great pride, he's a precinct captain, and you know where his hierarchy of values went.
Well, yeah, they were... I think lots of them who still are hanging around are convinced that the most important political post in the country after the presidency is the mayor of Chicago.
And Johnson came near to feeling that in 1964 because as the year went on, he really took a lot of advice from Daley, most of it really very good.
Of course, it is said by some, indeed Ben Bradley lays this out as a possibility in his book of so many years ago, Conversations with Kennedy, wasn't that the title? That there's that famous thing on election night where Daley calls him, and you remember the exact dialogue?
He says, Mr. President, with a little help from some close friends in Chicago, you're going to carry Illinois. And Johnson knew how powerful Daley was in general and also felt that he may have carried the 1960 election for John Kennedy and LBJ, so you've just heard LBJ working very hard to keep the old mayor on his side.
Yeah. The man didn't get any great joy out of the presidency, did he?
He didn't get any great joy out of very much, and that's sort of the problem, because...
Well, didn't he when he was majority leader of the Senate? He was in his heyday then.
He was in his heyday, but the problem is that, you know, if you basically lack self-esteem, you tend always to see the glass as half empty, and Johnson really did. Even when he was Senate majority leader, master of the Senate, getting all sorts of laws through, had the great esteem of his colleagues, still he always felt that there was something more that he didn't have. Then he becomes president in 1963, and all he can think about is his enemies, the reasons that he has to be unhappy, and in fact worries to a great extent about the possibility that John Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy, which really dogs him privately throughout the presidency.
He never believed, we learned from this in the findings of the Warren Report.
No, and that was one of the things that was really a shocker to me, because in the hours after he becomes president, after John Kennedy's murder, Johnson says he thinks it was a conspiracy. And he says, my first question was, when would the missiles be coming? And what was going on here was that Johnson had been privately briefed, this was the height of the Cold War, that if the Russians ever try to do a surprise nuclear attack against the United States, it would probably be preceded by an effort to assassinate the president and the vice president. That's what he thought this was. Then the next morning you hear him on the tapes being told by J. Edgar Hoover, we saw Lee Harvey Oswald 2 months ago outside the Cuban embassy in Mexico City. You know, Milt Johnson, it was once said that he always thought that the shortest distance between two points was a tunnel. And this is a very conspiracy-minded guy. From that moment, he suspected that Fidel Castro was behind the Kennedy assassination. And then in September of 64, Warren Commission, appointed by him, turns in its report, single gunman, no conspiracy, single bullet theory, and you hear Johnson talking to Richard Russell, his old friend from Georgia, senator, who says, I just signed that Warren Commission report, but I don't believe it. And then you hear Johnson say, I don't either.
You wonder if the Kennedys believed it.
That's something that is a question, and we don't know very much about that. Robert Kennedy in 1966 was asked by Richard Goodwin, did he really believe in the findings of the Warren Commission? It was a door that Robert Kennedy very much did not want to open because I think he had a sense that perhaps the assassination plots against Fidel Castro that he may very well have been a part of might have backfired.
Robert Kennedy, someplace in your book, characterizes him. I forget where you get this material, because obviously it isn't in conversation with Johnson. He characterizes Johnson as sort of a man-eater, as a primitive.
He says Johnson is an animal in many ways.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that Johnson said that about himself. He said, I'm like an animal that you have to put on a leash. And when you hear him in private on these tapes, that really is the sense that you get of him.
Here's one where you really hear him devouring somebody else. Absolutely riding roughshod over another member of the Kennedy family as an in-law, Sergeant Shriver. This one is number six on our list, I say to my friends in the booth. Explain the background on this.
Well, it's February of 1964. Johnson wants someone to lead this new war on poverty that we just heard him telling Mayor Daley about. $1 billion, but no plan, no staff. And the whole thing has a very big potential to collapse on the head of the person who has this job. And so Johnson wants to give the job to Sergeant Shriver, who was the director of the Peace Corps, also had been president of the Chicago Board of Education in the 1950s.
And was the brother-in-law of of the Kennedy boys.
Most importantly.
Yeah.
And Johnson, in this great fight with Robert Kennedy, felt that one way of fighting Robert Kennedy was to get as many members of the Kennedy family beholden to Johnson. So he butters up Ted Kennedy. He calls Jackie Kennedy on these tapes. He even calls Joe Kennedy, who had had this stroke and was unable to speak in his wheelchair at Hyannisport. And so as his hostage number one, he wants Sergeant Shriver as director of the War on Poverty, but Shriver doesn't want the job because he knows it could end his career.
Yeah.
And Johnson deals with this the way that he dealt with these things. He basically says, I'm just going to go out and announce your appointment, and if you want to renounce what I've said, go ahead.
It's pure steamroller. Here it is.
Sarge, good morning, Mr. President. How are you?
I'm going to announce your appointment at press conference.
What press conference?
This afternoon.
Well, God, I think it would be advisable, if you don't mind, if I could have this weekend, I wanted to sit down with a couple of people and see what we could get in the way of some sort of a plan, because what happens, at least my thought is, that what happens is that you announce somebody or hear somebody else, and they don't know what the hell they're doing or what the program's going to be specifically, and who's going to carry it, then you're in a hell of a hole because they start calling you up and saying, well, now, what are you going to do?
Don't talk to them. Just go away and go to Camp David. Figure it out. We need something to say to the press. We've got to say to them, and I've got to tell them what I talked to you about yesterday. And you can just take off, work out your Peace Corps any way you want to. You can be head of the committee and have some acting operator. If you want Bill to help you, I'll let him do that. I'll do anything, but I want to announce this and get it behind me so I quit getting all these other pressures. And I think you've got to do it. You just can't let me down. So the quicker we get it behind us, the better. And generally speaking,
could you just say that you've asked me to study this?
No, hell no. They've studied and studied and studied. They want to know who in the hell's going to do this, and it's leaked all over the papers for 2 weeks that you're going to do it, and they'll be shooting me with questions. They already done it. And I want to say that you're going to be special assistant president and executive in charge of the poverty program, and how that affects your Peace Corps relationship, you'll still maintain it, but you will be glad to go into that with them at a later date. At the present, you're working up the organization for this. What's wrong with that?
Well, the problem with it is that, knock the crap out of the Peace Corps.
Not if they tell them that you're not severing your identification with the Peace Corps.
Well, of course, you've got the sense of the situation. I must say that I would prefer it, Mr. President, if I had a 48 hours even to work with our staff around the world so that they won't hear this over the worldwide Voice of America or something like that. They might.
It's not going to be anything but a compliment to you. They're going to be proud of you. They're going to be applauding you. I'm not taking you away from that. I'm just giving you $1 billion more to work with. And if you can't run a $100 million program in your left hand and a billion with your right hand, you're not as smart as I think you are.
Besides, the money's got, that's no problem at all. It's the people that I'm in.
Well, the people,
I want to keep all these people for the government that are in the Peace Corps and bring them into any other program so that they...
Well, that's good. I'm not going to sever you from the Peace Corps at all. I'm going to say that you're going to maintain your identification with the Peace Corps. And I'm going to make that clear. But I am going to make it clear that you're Mr. Poverty. And a home and abroad, you ought to be. And I don't care who you have run the Peace Corps. If you can run it, wonderful. If you can't, get Oshkosh from Chicago, and I'll name him.
I can't get anybody. The only guy that could possibly do it, Mr. President, is Bill.
Well, you can write your ticket.
Well, there is the irresistible force rolling over the movable object, I would say.
Yeah, and it was also dumb on Johnson's part, because oftentimes people did not want these jobs for a good reason. One big example is 1965. He wanted to put his old friend, the lawyer Abe Fortas, his confidential advisor, on the Supreme Court. Fortas did not want the nomination, and the reason was because Fortas knew that he had been involved in some possibly scandalous financial dealings that he didn't want to tell Johnson about. Johnson walks into the press room, announces his appointment, and so basically puts Fortas on the Supreme Court against his will. Later on, of course, as we remember, Fortas had to get off to perhaps avoid being impeached.
One of the few people who ever resigned from the Supreme Court, in fact.
That's exactly right.
But he goes
right
on, as I remember, to be the head of our U.N. delegation, doesn't he, at that point?
Arthur Goldberg was the ambassador
to
the U.N.
Oh, it was Goldberg who went off the Supreme
Court. And Johnson got Goldberg off the court by saying to Goldberg, I need someone to be at the U.N. You're going to solve the Vietnam War. Huh. And as a matter of fact, I need a vice president in 1968, and maybe you might be it. And Goldberg, of course, was dumb enough to listen to all this, and he gave up a lifetime appointment.
He was a great manipulator of men, as well as of women, apparently.
That he was, and you see him in full form on these tapes.
Yeah. He's larger than life.
That's right. And, you know, with Johnson also, every single emotion is sort of 140%.
Uh-huh.
When he's angry, he is so furious, and you can hear him. You know, it's scary because, for instance, you hear him screaming at a Secret Service agent, Rufus Youngblood. And Youngblood was not only an ordinary agent, he was the one who had thrown his body across Johnson's during the shots in Dallas on mm-hmm. November 22nd, had potentially saved his life. And when Johnson is charming, he's charming to the nth degree. And at the same time, when he's also depressed, he's depressed in a way that you think that he will be almost paralyzed and do things to harm himself.
He also apparently has ways of humiliating people close to him, which in some ways binds them to him by some strange ambivalent connections that they may not fully understand. Is it true? I run the risk of indelicacy here, but still, after all, I am a psychologist, and this is fascinating material. Is it true that he would often, in essence, conduct court while mounted on the throne in the bathroom?
In fact, that has been one of these stories for all these years, Milt, that are so good you almost hope that it's true, but perhaps suspect is not. And the tapes confirm it, because hear him calling people from the toilet. And the chief victim of this was the aforementioned McGeorge Bundy. And Johnson
was
would
he on the
be,
phone from the toilet, or does he have him in the bathroom?
Have him in the bathroom, that's and right. It's on the tape. And
yeah.
He once, in fact, perhaps more than once, was sitting on the throne there with the door open and would call Bundy in to see him. And he knew that this would put the aide at a disadvantage. And Bundy had his back turned, and Johnson would say, Mac, come a little closer. I can't hear what you're saying. And Bundy stepped backward toward Johnson, and Johnson would say, turn around, I can't see your face.
Huh.
And Bundy had a look of great distaste. And Johnson later told other aides he couldn't understand how someone like Bundy had come so far in life.
What do you make of that?
I think it was a desire to humiliate,
perhaps,
put people on the defensive. And it was also this bizarre relationship he had with those people he called the Harvards, like Bundy.
Mm-hmm.
He disdained them, but he also envied them, and they made him feel very small in comparison.
Yeah. Some commercials once again, and it is time indeed to invite telephone calls. Anything you'd like to ask, or anything, if you're old enough, you'd like to remember about Lyndon Baines Johnson and those days. The number 591-7200. The lines are open at this moment, magically and instantly, and if you want to call, you should move very quickly. 591-7200. We return right after these words.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Now, back to Milt Rosenberg.
And we return to Michael Beschloss and to calls for him based upon what we've been talking about and listening to tonight. The book in hand is Taking Charge. The collection of audio tapes in hand is also titled Taking Charge. The Johnson White House tapes, 1963-64, and that is published by Simon & Schuster. 591-7200. Here is the first caller. Good evening.
Good evening. Wonderful. First-rate program tonight.
Thanks, sir.
If you would permit me two observations. The first one is that I'd be interested in what your guest thinks we need to develop a policy in terms of, as there was news management of history, by the selective releases of tapes from the various presidential libraries. And I think particularly the great selectivity by the Kennedy Library, and to show you how we have to regard history so differently. The release of tapes or accounts of tapes this year that Nixon had authorized the break-in of the Brookings Institution in 1971 If we had known this for all that this country went through during Watergate, that would have effectively destroyed the presumption of ignorance or good faith which many of us were willing to give Nixon at the time. Second quick point. I know that students of the presidency have often said this, but what the tapes really bring across that you've been playing tonight is the need for presidents to have detached, candid advisors who will speak truth to power. Even in the daily tape, it's very interesting how not only deferential, but how unctuous so many, if not most, people are who come in contact with the presidents.
I've agreed with almost everything I've heard. That's an absolutely terrific comment. I guess the only difference I would have is that in the case of the Johnson tapes, these are not a bit selective. This is virtually the whole hog for 63 and 64. And one of the things, frankly, I was very worried about when I began this project was when I began listening to the tapes, I wanted to make sure that this was not some sanitized collection with just Lyndon in concert saying what a wonderful person he was in private. And, you know, some of the things that very quickly made me see that these were not selective was I listened to a tape about a week after Johnson becomes president, and he's got a business manager in Austin, Texas, down where he came from, who says, "Mr. President, can I speak pretty freely on this line?" And Johnson says, "Yes." And the guy goes on to discuss envelopes of cash that had obviously been given to him for Lyndon Johnson, then the vice president. LBJ says, "Now that I'm president, you should return these things." That's just the kind of thing that LBJ then or 100 years later would not want heard. There's another one where Johnson is told by an old Texas friend, "Mr. President, quit trying to make my wife." The two had had dinner a couple of nights earlier. There are other references like the Helen Gehagen Douglas conversation we heard earlier in this program, and also Johnson's use of the FBI. There is a lot on these tapes that shows Johnson in a very unattractive way. And I'm one of the big critics of presidential libraries, and in fact, we're going to do a segment on presidential libraries on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer next week on the day that the Bush Library is dedicated in Texas. It's the 6th of November, I think it's Thursday. And there is a great tendency in many of these libraries to manage history, but here in this one case, I think the Johnson Library and the Johnson family deserve an awful lot of credit because there are a lot of these tapes that show Johnson, not the Johnson the Great, but Johnson the Small.
What do you do, for example? The taping went back to the Roosevelt presidency, although it was more primitive then. What do you do, for example, with the Kennedy Library? Because now more than any other presidency in the last 30 or 40 years, we realize how really sanitized and distorted the official record was on this.
The Kennedy Library, I have to say, frankly, has really been pretty bad on this. There was a very great effort to let documents come out in a trickle and be very careful about those that might cast John Kennedy in a critical light. And I think it really sort of backfired. I think it's been a mistake because historians are humans. And when you go into a library and you have a sense that the library is extremely worried about the reputation of the president it commemorates, the natural reaction any scholar has is there must be something here to hide and I'd better investigate all the harder.
What would you as a historian recommend be done to try to correct the situation?
Well, I think one thing is that for historians to complain if necessary, or if really necessary, have lawsuits to get documents out, because after all, these documents were done on government time by government employees, and we, the American people, have the right to see and hear them.
Finally, do you agree on the assessment about Nixon now, with the latest disclosures?
Well, actually, the Nixon stuff has come out not from the Nixon Library, but from the National Archives, and that is as a result of a very courageous effort by a lot of historians, including especially Stanley Cutler of the University of Wisconsin, to get these things out.
Sir, we've got to run on. I do appreciate your call. A very interesting contribution indeed. And here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, yes, I had a question, great show first, but I had a question about the connection between the civil rights legislation and the political cost that it had with his decision to get into Vietnam. And I was wondering if I recollect correctly, one of the civil rights acts came about a week before the commitment in terms of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. I wonder if there was a connection there in the timing of it that he felt that there was such a political cost that was incurred with the Civil Rights Act that made him maybe a little bit weaker in terms of making a decision about Vietnam.
Great question. What you hear on the tapes is that Johnson very much linked the two. He wanted things like the Civil Rights Act and also the War on Poverty Bill, and he felt that if he were tough on Vietnam in the summer of 64, that would give him the political strength to get the kind of liberal domestic legislation he really wanted. One thing that really ties it all together is the very night that he retaliated for this alleged attack on an American destroyer in the Gulf of Tonkin, April 4, 1964, just as he's about to bomb North Vietnam, there's a tape, and I've got it in the book, where he calls up Larry O'Brien, his congressional liaison, and says, "What do you think the effect will be if I bomb the hell out of North Vietnam tonight? What will the effect be on our war on poverty?" And O'Brien chuckles and says, "It certainly won't hurt."
A tough trade-off.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's one way of sort of seeing the way a president links these things.
Sure. Well, thanks a lot. Great show.
Thank you, sir, for the call. The number 591-7200. 312 is the area code if you're calling long distance. And we go to the next one. Hello, you're on the air.
Classic show as usual, and I can't wait to read the book. I seem to recall that you talked earlier about the in your heart, you know he's right. Seems to me the retort was, in your heart, you know he might, speaking of the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, I remember watching the Kid Radicals in 68 in Chicago, often from rather prosperous backgrounds, vilifying Johnson and actually helping elect Richard Nixon, a legacy that the political Woodstockers never seemed to acknowledge. But my question is this. Do you think that there was, how much was the class and regional prejudice against Johnson responsible for some of the criticism he took?
I think it was very great, and he sure thought so. You hear him a lot on these tapes saying, "They just won't let me have a chance, you know, those people in the North and perhaps in the West. They think that I'm ignorant because I didn't go to a college like Harvard, and they just won't let a Southerner be president." And, of course, he always felt with great rightness that he was being compared against the stylish, articulate John Kennedy of Boston.
And yet he was probably, in most ways, more liberal than Kennedy was, you know?
Yeah, I came to believe from listening to these tapes that he had a gut, emotional commitment to things like civil rights that John Kennedy really did not have. John Kennedy could rationally say, "I think it is a good thing for black Americans to get their civil rights," but Johnson, I think, was willing to take political risks for that John Kennedy would not.
Can't wait to read the book. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for the call. And we will take care of a last round of commercials and then directly back for more calls. And we need to work in at least one more excerpt from the recorded material. All of that to follow right after this.
Extension 720 continues now on Radio 720 WGN. Again, Milt Rosenberg.
And directly back to your calls to Michael Beschloss. Here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg and Mr. Beschloss.
Hi.
A question and then a couple questions procedurally regarding your book and maybe a future book. Could you describe Lyndon Johnson's decision-making model in terms of foreign policy in comparison to domestic policy based on these tapes?
I think what I would say is that on domestic policy, he's really a master because he understands it and cares about it and knows how to get it through the Senate and the House. When you hear him dealing with foreign policy, it's almost a different human being. He's rather quiet. He's deferential to these people like Bundy and McNamara and Rusk and others. And he's really not the same person in control. And as a result, you know, you sort of think about what would have happened with John Kennedy on Vietnam in the later 1960s and what would have happened with Lyndon Johnson. I am not one who thinks that Kennedy would have immediately pulled us out of Vietnam after the 1964 election had he lived. But I think one of the differences is that John Kennedy knew foreign affairs. He knew both the weaknesses and the strengths of people like Bundy and McNamara, so that if they gave him advice that he felt was a little bit full of it on occasion, he'd be able to see through them and master them rather than be mastered by them. And I think it's one reason why Johnson got so deeply in Vietnam without being more skeptical of what he was doing.
A question regarding the audio version. Is the audio version primarily the tapes themselves?
The audio version is mainly the tapes themselves, occasionally interrupted by me to explain what's going on.
And one last quick question. Will this be the first of possibly a series of volumes based on these audio tapes?
It is the first of three volumes, which will take Johnson all the way through the presidency.
Great book. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for the call. Back to the phones in a moment. There's a crucial tape we want to play right now. It reflects something so interesting. This is Johnson telling George Reedy, his press secretary, that on the second day of the Democratic Convention, which is being held up in Atlantic City, as I remember it, that he's probably not going to run for the presidency after all.
I mean, it's the most amazing thing, Milt, because here Johnson is. He's about to be nominated unanimously, get this landslide election, he knows, against Barry Goldwater. It's day two of the convention. On day three, he's going to get the nomination. And here he is in a state of bleak depression, almost paralyzed, saying that the helicopters are outside the White House and he's going to take them and go up to Atlantic City and tell the delegates he's instead going to retire to Texas, even though he knows that the result will probably be that his great enemy, Bobby Kennedy, would be nominated.
Let's hear it, and then I want you to explain it to me. Here's the tape.
Here's what I think I'm going to say to him, whatever number of months it is. 44 months ago, I was selected to be the Democratic Vice President. 44 months ago, I was elected to be the Democratic Vice President. In the time given me, I did my best. On that fateful November day last year, I accepted the responsibility of the President, asking God's guidance and the help of all of our people. For 9 months, I've carried on as effectively as I could. Our country faces grave dangers. These dangers must be faced and met by a united people under a leader they do not doubt. After 33 years of political life, most men acquire enemies as ships accumulate barnacles. The times require leadership about which there is no doubt, and a voice that men of all parties and sections and color can follow. I've learned after trying very hard that I'm not that voice or that leader. Therefore, and then I'm going to say therefore, I suggest that the representatives from all states of this union selected for the purpose of selecting a Democratic nominee and for President and Vice President proceed to do their duty and that no consideration be given to me because I'm absolutely unavailable. That's, I think then they can just pick the two they want for the two places. We'll take the nominee and do the best we can to help him till January. And then if he's elected, well, that's fine. I think he will be. And he can have a new and fresh fellow without any of the old scars. And I don't want this power of the bomb, and I just don't want these decisions I'm being required to make. And I don't want the conniving that's required. I don't want the disloyal that's around. I don't want the bumbling and the inefficiencies. And our people and all of them talk too much.
This will throw the nation quite an uproar, sir.
Yeah, I think so. And I think now's the time. I don't know any better time. They're there and they've got nothing else to do. And I'm absolutely positive that I cannot lead the South, the North and the South. And I don't want to lead the nation without my own state, without my own section. I'm very convinced that the Negroes will not listen to me. They're not going to follow a white Southerner. And I think the stakes are too big to try to compromise. I looked at the Herald Tribune, and there's nothing but things that we've done terrible. I read the New York Times. We had a pallid platform. That is outrageous. I picked up every paper I had this morning. We had just played hell. And there's just bound to be a lot of people that don't have these doubts, these angers, and these barnacles, and these things they have to carry, and the nation ought to have a chance to get the best available. That's who I want my children to have.
Every possible burden, every possible preoccupation is represented in that monologue.
It almost sounds like someone on a psychiatrist's couch.
It does.
You sort of wonder, I mean, you know, with your training in political psychology, one of the things that you look for is a leader responding to dangers that are real or dangers that are imagined? And what he's responding to, you know, I heard this tape, and then I sort of looked up what was bothering him. What was bothering him was some minor press criticism, the kind of press that Bill Clinton would probably beg for. I mean, much nicer than anything that's been written about a president in recent years. And also the possibility of a floor fight over the seating of an all-white Mississippi delegation. A political problem, to be sure, but not one of very great magnitude. But if you listen to Johnson, as we've just listened to him, you'd think he was dealing with something like Pearl Harbor, some major political event. And this suggests a president who really did not have very great psychic reserves.
What happened? That was on the second day of the convention. How did he manage to get to the floor to accept the nomination?
What happened is what happens all the way through this presidency, which is Lady Bird said, come here.
Ah.
She spent a couple of hours with him in the bedroom in the White House family quarters. And, you know, I also quote from her tape diary throughout this book, and she said of those hours, I do not remember hours I ever found harder. And what happened was, she said, you want to pull out? The Democratic Party is going to nominate Bobby Kennedy, whom you hate. Barry Goldwater might be elected. You may feel that you're not the best candidate available. You may know your limitations. Those are the kind of things he was saying, but you do have a job to do.
Do you think it was essentially the same mood, the same psychodynamic process that gripped him 4 years later when he did pull out?
I do, and you sort of think, Milt, that 4 years later, I mean, this is 64 when everything's going wonderfully. 4 years later, the kids were in the streets. Johnson could not speak anywhere but at military bases. He was being reviled as a Hitler. And if Johnson is feeling insecure and angry in August of 1964, imagine how he feels by 1968 when he really does pull out.
Or by 1966 when all of the protests has already begun to mount in a serious way. Maybe his intensification of the war is his adaptation to the presence of that criticism. I'm going to show them, though they all hate me, that what I've committed the nation to at a high cost ultimately has a high payoff, has a higher payoff.
Absolutely. And I think maybe also there's a little bit of an element in the conversation we've just heard. Johnson knew that he was going to have to make some horrible decisions in Vietnam one way or the other, and he may have known that the next presidential term would be a living hell for whoever held it.
Yeah. One more quick call, at least five. I've got the ultimate question I want to raise for you, but I'll do that after yet another call on 591-7200, 591-7200, and we go to this caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening, Milt. What a great history lesson tonight. You truly moderate a university of the air.
Thank you, sir.
That's for sure.
Mr. Beschloss, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I remember that assassination as if it were last weekend. Did Robert Kennedy ever express any feelings in private conversation or writing, any suspicions that Lyndon Johnson might have had prior knowledge of or even a participation in that plot?
You know, I've been through all the sources and I've never seen RFK say that. But, you know, on these tapes, and I've got it in the book, Johnson kept very close watch on the Jim Garrison investigation. And I do have a few tapes in the book that go beyond the 63-64 period that relate to the assassination. And one of the things that you hear is Johnson being told by one of his aides that Garrison is investigating evidence that LBJ himself may have been linked to the assassination. I don't think anyone serious suggested that at the time. I don't think Robert Kennedy did suggest that. Although at the same time, a lot of the subtext of what Robert Kennedy was saying and thinking was that Lyndon Johnson somehow usurped my brother's office, and that was almost the tacit suggestion.
It's funny, that weekend when it happened, that was the first thing that went through my mind, and it's still there.
Well, you weren't alone, nor are you today.
Well, thank you. Your book is a must-buy. Thank you.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
You bet.
Payoff question that I signaled I was going to ask you, but it's one you're totally familiar with and ready for, I know. The historians like to play the game of what they call counterfactuals. You are very much focused on how the accidents of character and the dynamics of human interaction based upon character and based upon misperception and maybe even on flashes of paranoia, how all of that ultimately produces policy, produces major decisions. So play the counterfactual. What if the assassination had not taken place in Dallas? Or take any other particular supposition to start the counterfactual. What if Lyndon Johnson had, in fact, followed through on what he told George Reedy he was about to do and had chosen not to run? Where would we be? What would have happened?
Well, I think if Johnson had not run in 1964, the Democrats would have nominated Robert Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy would have been faced with making some of the decisions on Vietnam that LBJ did, as would John Kennedy had he lived, which is the other question you're raising. And my guess is that with either Kennedy, they probably would have made very similar decisions to Johnson's on Vietnam, probably in 65 and maybe into 66. And remember, Milt, also, as you do, that they would have been surrounded by exactly the same advisors, Rusk, McNamara, Bundy. Those were all Kennedy people. But my guess is because John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy had very different psychological makeups from Lyndon Johnson's, they were a lot more secure and self-confident, they wouldn't have felt that their manhood was tied up in this war. And I think perhaps by late 1966, they may have felt that they would have the political and psychological strength to wind down the war if it looked as it did look, that it might well be a loser.
You think that would have happened with either of the Kennedy brothers in the presidency?
I think that's my best guess, although, you know, the argument made by the partisans of John Kennedy is always that he supposedly told them, I first have to get reelected in 1964, mm-hmm. and then I'll pull the troops out in 1965. And one problem with John Kennedy always was that he was always saying, you know, I'm going to demonstrate this kind of political courage, but I have to get reelected first. Yeah. I suspect that there may have been a tendency to think, even if he was reelected, 1965 comes along, there are other domestic things he wants to do, he can't be called soft on communism, so let's escalate in Vietnam so that he could get a second-term domestic program through, or perhaps Bobby Kennedy might want to run for president in 1968, so keep the Vietnam War running so that he is not weak and vulnerable. I think that there is always a danger in trying to imagine too far ahead what might have happened.
It really is atrocious to consider. I was raising this earlier. You agreed with me, and I know you will agree with me now as well. It's atrocious to consider that not only Lyndon Johnson, but probably the Kennedys also did and would have, if they were there in the presidency, make decisions that ultimately have the consequence of killing millions of people, but make those decisions essentially for mere political advantage.
Absolutely, because the argument made by the Kennedy partisans would be that Kennedy would have waited until 65 to pull out, and what that suggests is that he would have callously and cynically put American boys mm-hmm. in harm's way, killed them during 1964 into 1965 merely for electoral purposes.
Years ago, when we were just beginning this program, I think I was just a year or two into doing it, there came Kenny O'Donnell with that book that he and Dave Powers did, Johnny, We Hardly Knew You. And Kenny O'Donnell assured me that, yes, Kennedy was ready to pull out of Vietnam, but he had to wait till after the election. That same night, he also assured me that there was no such person as Judith Campbell Exner, and if there was, she had never been in the White House or in any kind of hailing distance of John F. Kennedy.
Well, sometime, maybe someday, Niagara Falls will flow backward and pink pigs will fly.
You've done a wonderful labor with, but it doesn't come out laboriously. It comes out, of course, in a way that is utterly fascinating and captivating. And you don't have to be a history buff to enjoy this. This is tremendous human material. The new book by Michael Beschloss is titled Taking Charge, the Johnson White House Tapes, 1963-1964, Simon & Schuster, the publishers, and published along with it, issued along with it, is a set of four tapes, 6 hours worth of this material, some of which we've been sampling tonight. Same title and same publisher, Simon & Schuster. Obviously, you have to buy both. And I trust they're being sold together at all the bookstores.
I think so, and just want to say I always learn from you, Milt, and I have again tonight.
Well, it's been a wonderful evening, and I very much appreciate your coming. I should say before we end for the night that we urge you, as we always do on Friday night, to get your hands on the Chicago Tribune this Sunday, and particularly to get to the book review section, which has fine reviews, notices of literary events. Have they reviewed Taking Charge yet?
No, they haven't. I'm hoping they will on Sunday or maybe a week later.
It will be either this week or next week, I am sure. It's a great pleasure having had you here. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thanks, Milt.
And thanks to all for listening. With that, we wind down for the night. We're talking tomorrow night about enigmas in science with three worthy guests who I don't have time to tell you about right now, but I will tomorrow at 9. Until then, a cordial good night to all.